Welcome. My name is Carl Schostrom, and this is the final part of the abridged version of the discussion that John Butters and I recorded in the late summer of 2023. We talk about family businesses, executive compensation, and long-term incentives. And in this final part, we talk about the construction of a long-term incentive plan. Follows on from the salary and benchmarking and incentives discussions of the first and second parts, and the beginning of details of a long-term incentive plan in the previous part. This is, of course, all from the video version that you can find on YouTube. You can find it at www.vt.solutions and also at isbahaniadvisory.com.
We've done a lot of theoretical stuff about LTIPs now.
Yeah.
And I'd like to get down a little bit more to the features of the construction of them. So I've got two groups here, structural questions and complexities. So if I start with the sort of the basic structural questions. The first one is, who should participate?
Right. So for a long-term incentive, we can achieve, as we discussed before, different purposes. And you can use it in different ways depending on, again, type of organization and so on that you are. So you may want to have an incentive where everybody participates. You talked about the profit share before. You know, the savers you earn plans and so on, where you invite everybody in the company to share in the long-term success of the business. Then you can use a long-term incentive and some short-term incentives as being a member of the club. There's a lot of value if you look at like Maslow hierarchy of needs, kind of satisfaction that we at some point need to clothe and feed ourselves and our family, and so we need to provide for that. But then we go into self-esteem, self-actualization. How can we as an organization touch on some of those factors to get value out of our employees? Now, being a member of the club, getting recognition for that you are one of the senior team, but the broader population can be very effective. Can be a very strong way of maybe not paying so much to the individual, but giving them recognition for that. You know, you are a key contributor. You are someone who we value in this organization. We see that you have a great future here. That signal can come through an incentive. Many organizations use that.
That strikes me as a good club to be able to offer rather than a board seat. You know, I think
it can be.
Can end up offering a board seat as that kind of welcome, you're in the club now.
Yes.
But then, you know, that doesn't necessarily think about board dynamics and who contributes as a director separately from contributing as an executive or expert.
Yeah.
So I like the idea of having another club into which people can be inducted.
And then you have those that you want to or need to, and you have to be careful. So to what extent do you have to what extent do you want to have people in the group that share in the wealth creation of the business? So where there's more serious money in the long-term incentive, where people are, they have preferably a strong line of sight to delivering results for the company, to being able to impact the strategic direction of the company. People who you do not want to lose interest in where you are going as an organization. That's the final tier, if you like, of incentives. You can use incentives for other purposes as well, but I'd say those are the common key usages of a long-term incentive.
What about the scheme length? So we looked at the scheme length and we were inclined to go longer. but actually discussions with you are quite useful, that your view has been, well, managers don't believe anything that happens beyond 3 years. I'm paraphrasing in my own way. But, you know, the market standard in listed companies is 3 years, and there's a reason for that, because longer than that is getting a bit long.
It is. There's no science to it, but we want a period that is longer than the year. And we tend to define short-term incentive, 12 months and less. Some have quarterly, biannual, but most have annual incentives. And then long-term incentives, anything longer. Depending on who you are, what business you are, and so on, you will have different length perspectives on time. But you also need to take into consideration the individual's perspective on time. So how long do they plan to be in the job? How long is a reasonable expectation to be with a company in different roles? And are there cycles to be met? And if you take a three-year cycle, 3 year is a time period for most individuals that is yes, you can look at and you can see yourself being there. Having a five-year plan makes that tougher for the individual.
Yes.
You are, you know, it's a long way
out. You've
got
to do your full 5 years before anything happens.
Exactly. So you know, to get people engaged, not having to pay gap payments to keep people locked in. 3 years have just worked out for most as a reasonable time period, but it's not universal. Different companies struggle with different things. So many tech companies, for example, they have vesting that is annual. Mm. So maybe in a third. Some even have monthly. And back in Silicon Valley, you'll find very intense plans that work as well. And it all depends on how you are as a business, what the retention needs, what kind of patterns people are likely to be following. But 3 years as a general rule has evolved as the standard timing in Europe.
I was also very concerned about having a 3 year or a 5 year one-off scheme, partly because, going back to the point about it's the family saying, this is what we want. We're not clear over what we want over 3 years. We have a much longer time horizon than that. Also, I'm very wary in our business of having these cliff edges, because it is a decision point. You have a good 3 years and you say to management, right, here's a bunch of money. And it's tantamount to saying, do you want to stay or do you want to go? And saying that to our whole team at once in our business, where we would struggle to re-recruit everybody all at once. I don't think we've got the capacity to do that. Just seemed very frightening to me. So we have gone for these overlapping schemes where each year we launch a new three-year scheme. This is in the yield business. And I think that's very common, and it's what public companies are tending to do as well. I think I've probably said enough that people get the idea. The problem with it is this immediately starts to bend people's minds. And after swimming in it for a while, what I'm seeing is the point is it's a lock-in mechanism. And it can also be a good lever mechanism that you say, well, if you're a good lever or a graceful lever, we'll let you keep some of these things. Whenever you resign, you're always going to have two live plans running that you're going to lose if you leave. So it's a graceful lever mechanism and it's a lock-in mechanism. But this is quite mind-bending for people. So how have you found boards react to this structure?
Yeah, no, it is... In particular, as you say, it's common practice in publicly quoted companies, so that you get less reaction there, less so in privately held companies. In the private equity sector, as you've described, you want to have the payout at the exit. That's how the whole business case works, and the incentives have to follow that. But I don't think I've come across a one-off plan where there hasn't been an exodus of some sort after, if it has been successful.
Yeah, okay. So if there's a one-off plan and a cliff edge, yes, there's almost always an exodus of managers at that point.
It's very, very common because you are, by design, creating a point of reflection for, do I want to stay for another 3 years? If you have ongoing plans, it is just part of your reward that is being delayed. If it is one-off, then you create a point of reflection where each executive has to think about, am I in or am I not? And it may be that they're in, but they can only see another two years forward for themselves. And if you'd had ongoing, every year plans, that wouldn't have been an issue. But now it becomes an issue.
Mm-hmm.
So they jump. And or they go and get that new role.
You mentioned earlier the importance of having a cap, and this was around the formula risk you were talking about. It's another of the things, the kind of key pillars that I've taken from you. You were very strong on always have a cap.
Yes.
And, you know, it's quite intuitively appealing to say, well, there's no cap, guys. You make our business a wild success, and you get a wild payout.
Yes.
But you didn't advise that at all, and that was interesting.
No, I think it's important to consider the risks of the plan. And uncapped plans, as I said before, the threat to the company from a long-term incentive in particular is the formula. And I have not designed, but I've seen plans that have gone seriously wrong on the formula and look to pay out way beyond what was reasonable or and should have been paid, leading to court cases and so on.
Mm.
The cap can be high. There's nothing stopping you from that, but the board should consider at which point it's not reasonable for the family to be paying whatever amount it is. And yes, there are risks of sandbagging and manipulation of results and so on, but the risks of an uncapped payout for beyond what the board can envisage today, that, you know, if you're not quoted in your family business, you can still pay more. That is open to you.
It's a good point. You can always pay more.
You can, you know, if you see after 2 years that there's a massive opportunity and if management takes it and they double the value of the business, you can put in another incentive. But you know, to backtrack on a promise and capping an incentive just before vesting, that will not lead to a harmonious relationship between management and the board.
Well, let's go on to complexities then.
Yeah.
Complexities, where I hope we don't get too lost. The first one we've touched on, I've written EBIT, EBITDA, net profit, comprehensive income, cash flow, operating profit, .. You do need a core metric. And again, another thing that you advised us was keep it relatively simple. You've got to have, even a simple plan is going to be full of complexities.
Yeah.
Just because of that thing we talked about earlier, or I talked about earlier, of taking a simple idea and rendering it into maths.
Yeah.
If you're then doing that with a profit concept or a return on capital concept that people don't really understand, you're just creating a whole world of further confusion and mistrust potentially.
Yeah.
So one almost has to pick one of these common measures of company performance. But which one? And I've really struggled, particularly with net profit versus EBITDA. You know, to some extent, we're a yield business. And so the more EBITDA you can take out, the better. And then it becomes the board's responsibility to make sure enough investment is going back in. If you're using net profit, you are paying out of, you're more reliably paying out of cash you're likely to have, because you've got that depreciation charge in there, which on our business is a pretty significant thing. But to some extent, you're disincentivizing capital investment, because the more capital investment you make, the bigger the depreciation charge. And anyway, so this is just my little problem, but there's a gazillion problems with choosing the metric.
Yeah, and in one's quest to make things less complex, you have to make a call. And the board will often have very different views because of people come from different angles and different experience and different background companies on which metrics are the more important. And it's quite healthy that at board level, because you'll have a debate around it, and just what you illustrated, these are things to consider when you're evaluating the strategy and the performance and what to do next. When it comes to the incentives, though, you got to come back to your signaling. So what is it you want to signal? And if you need to signal on those finer points, maybe just general profitability isn't where you should be going. So I would probably look first at what is the most common thing you talk about within the company. So if everybody in the company is talking about EBITDA, and that is the mantra from the CFO down throughout the organization on a daily basis, someone else suddenly starts to talk about EBIT or about net profit or about economic profit, which is, many people think it's where you take a capital charge into account, it gets confusing and mixed messages, and people start to switch off, or they'll most likely start to use the interpretation they prefer, which might go in a completely different direction to what you want to do. And then people would be disappointed because you know their EBITDA is up, but the net profits were down, and we were measuring on net profits, and so everybody thought it went really well, but we're paying nothing for it. So you just need to be consistent. You need to consider what's the message and how do we use this signaling most of all, and then pay accordingly. And if you need other buttons pressed, well, maybe we need to introduce a secondary measure like investments, making sure that there's sufficient investment decisions made and incentivize that, or whatever it may be that we're concerned about.
Let's go on to some other complexities. Should it be contractual? And you've said no. Again, we've made it very discretionary. But are there arguments on both sides, and also what legal risks arise, even if you write every way you possibly can that it's not a contractual entitlement?
Now, for some organisation in some countries, you can't remove that and you have to make it contractual. Some companies feel much more comfortable with it being contractual. But then you need to be very, very careful with how you set levels of opportunity, so how much you can earn, and also how easy or difficult it is to earn those levels of pay. Because if it's a contractual right, people could challenge you in that if you made it much harder to earn it, have you broken the contract?
Yes. Yeah. So you can have challenges all over the place.
Yeah, challenges all over the place. Good point. So it tends to be easier for the board to operate a discretionary plan.
A point that you made about discretion in our conversations when we were talking about, well, should we have this or that provision for good leavers. A good leaver looks like this, and if you're a good leaver, you get to keep that. This was another area where you said have discretion, and you made the very good point that what's a good leaver is very situational, that it might be that you want to say, well, how very kind of you for letting me know you want to go, and it would be great if you could go tomorrow. Yes. And in other cases, you might want to say, well, it would be extremely great if you could go in a year's time. And it's a good idea for the board to have discretion to say what is a good leaver in different situations.
You do have to be careful with setting precedents and so on. But family business, again, as you say, there are so many circumstances. And as long as you maintain trust between the board and management, and as you say, bear this in mind that, yes, if you're sitting in a room by yourself with just the board meeting and you're discussing what is a good and what is a bad lever, you may look at it very abstract, but just reflect back on this is how we will be treated. People will see us treating people like this. This impacts us as a business, as a family, and our reputation with our management, who we rely on to deliver value for us. Mm. It's easy to talk about it hypothetically, but it's hard when you put it into reality, and therefore to be able to have the discretion to call it according to the situation. I think if you can, that's valuable.
I'd just like to finish off with one last question. You are a consultant, of course, and you help people sculpt these things for a living. We haven't done an example really today of how you sculpt one. So, you know, I hope it hasn't been too philosophical and general for people, because I always love to hear the war stories about, well, this was the problem, so we did that. Yeah. What I'm interested in is how to manage the consultants that you take on to help you with this.
It is a very specialized subject, although we all think we're specialists on this because we get paid, but it is also, there's a lot of complexity. People are very worried about the complexity. Use the consultant to get through some of that complexity, to arrive at a common understanding, and maybe take it a step further to start looking at your reward philosophy. We touched on reward philosophy a few times, but it is very helpful if we can get, as an organization, a view on what we like and don't like when it comes to paying people for their work. And when it comes to allowing executives to share in the value creation, that's all we try to get at. And if we can get a view on things like, do we like incentives? You asked before, can I just have salary? Well, you can just have salary. It works. There are consequences of just having salary that you need to deal with if you're going to do that. Can I just have bonus and, you know, have people work on commissions? You can. But there are consequences to that. People can't rely on their compensation to have a house and food on the table and so on. Then they will act in different ways. You get behaviors and you get actions from the way you structure pay. Should we be a paternalistic organization? Many family businesses want to take care of their employees. Should we therefore have defined benefit pension plans? You can have that, but it's a massive risk to the family in making such promises, as many families have found out. So all those things, you know, the fundamentals, if one can agree on that as a board and as a family, that's extremely helpful. And you can have your advice itself with that. And from that, you can create policies. And it sounds very bureaucratic, but what a remuneration policy needs to be, and all it needs to be, is a framework within which your managers can take decisions.
You said consultants should advise and the board needs to decide.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the connecting threads of this whole discussion, that there's the basic point we talked about at the beginning. Your salary is for turning up and not doing a terrible job. Your bonus is for hitting this year's targets, whatever they may be. And your long-term incentive is for doing what the owners or the board have communicated to you is their long-term objective. So they have to know, they have to have something to say to you as an executive, otherwise there's no point in doing an LTIP. And they need to step up to the plate and grasp what they're asking for, because otherwise the whole thing just doesn't work. This whole thing is a kind of... I don't know what the right analogy is, a dangerous radioactive substance that you can also use to your benefit. It strips away the I don't know and the we're not sure, we don't manage them that very well, and there's this unspoken thing here and we don't really trust so-and-so, and we're not sure what return on capital we want, and so on and so on. It strips all of that away as you try and do, particularly an LTIP. You've got to get clear. And that is a great advantage, and it's also the great challenge of putting it in. That's what I found. Well, Carl, thank you very, very much.
My pleasure.
Very, very much. It's been a very interesting conversation. I've learned something. I've learned a lot, as I do every time we have a good conversation. So thank you very much. And I'm looking forward enormously to sharing this with Family Business UK members and whoever else we share it with in due course.
Great.
Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you.